You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 35 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And probably not the Super Bowl 51.
We'll get to that.
But this is the last Pelton Cast in calendar year 2016.
Well, I don't know if I would necessarily say that. I mean, there's a chance we might have a post Peach Bowl Pelton Cast December 31st.
Post Peach Pelton Cast.
Yes.
Coach Pete and the post Peach Pelton Cast.
That's a tongue twister. But this is the last scheduled Pelton Cast in calendar year 2016.
Regularly scheduled. And I thought that would be an important time for us to look back on. We've looked back on the year in sports, Seattle sports specifically.
We have. And if you haven't listened to that one, still fresh, will remain fresh probably for a while, except for your predictions about who the Seahawks will face in the Super Bowl.
This is an annual prediction. Even if the Seahawks were 2-14 at this point next year, I'm still predicting it.
Fair enough.
It's like apparently Chris Berman always predicted Bears or Bills 49ers or something in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Maybe it was Bills Cowboys. That always seemed like the Super Bowl in the 90s.
I'm pretty sure the Bills Cowboys was often the Super Bowl, yes.
But so we've looked back on the year in sports, which if you haven't listened to, you should stop listening right now and go listen to that.
I wouldn't necessarily say this. This is more timely. This is demands to be listened to right now before games happen this week.
Okay, we that demand one, you listen to this right now.
That one, again, will stay fresh for a while. It's like something you don't need to put in the fridge because it's just going to stay fresh.
We've looked back on the year in music.
We have.
And I thought it would be an important moment to look back briefly on the year in beer. So just like 45 minutes to an hour.
Yes. We're going to keep it light. That's the whole podcast, actually. We're not talking about the speech bowl at all. No. So something I started doing this year is New Year's resolution in 2016, which you also made.
Yeah, same New
Year. Kept for like a month.
It was no, like I kept it into April.
All right. But I kept all year was to record every beer I drank. And there was a couple I missed along the way, but it's pretty close to every single one. And so in honor of that, I thought that we would drink the one beer that earned a perfect 10 in my ratings.
This is the one beer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is the Ballast Point Grapefruit Sculpin.
Okay. This is kind of a beer specifically made for you.
It is, because I love grapefruit beers. And like the Sculpin on its own is one of the highest regarded IPAs out there, I think it's fair to say. So you combine those two, and it is pretty much designed for me. So can I tell you a little bit about the Grapefruit Sculpin?
Tell us about the Grapefruit Sculpin. Well, I'm going to crack them open while you do that, because I want to get talking about other things.
That's a great
idea. I'm excited to get to drinking this too.
Our award-winning IPA with a citrus twist. Our Grapefruit Sculpin is the latest take on our signature IPA. Some may say there are a few ways to improve Sculpin's unique flavor, but the tart freshness of grapefruit perfectly complements our IPA's citrusy hop character. Grapefruit's a winter fruit, but this easy-drinking ale tastes like summer. Which is true, which is why we should drink it in the middle of winter.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
To a great 2016 in beer.
So would you like to hear a little bit more about my year in beer?
Yeah, I want to hear your year in beer, and then I want to talk Grapefruit Sculpin.
Okay. What type of beer do you think I drank the most?
Type of beer?
Yes.
IPA.
Obviously.
Yeah.
That was 80 and a half IPAs.
Okay.
Next up was 31 lagers and 26 and a half pale ales. And then when you count like double IPA, session IPA.
You count those as separate?
And yeah, in grapefruit IPA, there was like citrus IPA. It was an average of about 2 IPAs per week.
Okay. How many total beers did you drink throughout the year?
It's about 340, I think.
Okay. So you averaged around a beer per day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is generally like, I try not to go beyond 7 per week. That's getting a little excessive.
Do you,
at that point.
So when you're tailgating, this is the place where it becomes an issue for me. Is when you're
recording?
Tailgating. Well, yes, recording. Because you don't even know necessarily how many you've drank, especially if you're drinking from, say, from a keg.
Yeah, there's some approximation involved here.
But also,
there's a guesstimate.
It becomes an issue for me because I'm drinking a lot of volume. And did you not have a situation where you're drinking high volume in one of those days? Seems like you'd be way more than that.
I probably did have a couple of situations like that.
How many Rainiers do you drink? Do you have this, this readily
course.
Available?
Of okay. course. That was going to be my next is the beer maker, the
okay.
highest rated beer maker. It is Rainier was number 2 Fremont number one, 23 Fremont beers,
okay.
16 Georgetown beers, 11 Sierra Nevada, 11 Pyramid, and 10 Ballast Point.
You had 11 Pyramid beers?
We'll get to that. No, I guess we're not. That's something else. I don't know why. Went to Pyramid a couple of times before, like, soccer games and things.
All right,
like
I was going to say I think I've had zero, but actually I do remember some specific times that I had Pyramid beers.
All right, then individual beers, not the maker, but the individual type of beer. Obviously, number one, Radier.
There we go.
At 18. Then number two, oddly, Widmer Off the Record Pale Ale, which is served only in the Blazers media room after games.
There you go. You had to say something exclusive.
Yeah. Those are the only two I had more than six beers of all year.
So we've drank. To me, I was going to say, I didn't record it throughout the year. And again, I'm drinking a lot more beer than you are. Would you agree with this assessment?
That's a fair assessment.
I'm drinking quite a bit more beer than you are, so it's more difficult to keep track of it.
Okay.
But also, you and I drank together Pliny the Elder numerous times, and that didn't achieve a perfect score?
It did not. It got like a 9.5.
And this Grapefruit Sculpin is better?
I think so.
So, okay, some thoughts about Grapefruit Sculpin. Sculpin is generally, I consider it the best readily available IPA.
Yes, I think you've made that claim in the past.
And when you add in the grapefruit, it's good, especially for the summer. How do you feel about the pineapple sculpin?
So here's an interesting thing. I was reviewing. There were eight beers that achieved a score of 9 or higher. Pliny the Elder, obviously, was number two. And there were several that got a 9, including pineapple sculpin.
Okay. Yes, but how do you feel about the habanero sculpin?
I have not tried it. Do not think I would be a fan.
No, that's not a beer for you.
Exactly. It's like Stranger Things. The other beers that achieved a score of 9, the Goose Island Matilda, which we talked about on last week's podcast.
Okay.
The Sierra Nevada Tropical IPA, which I hope to get my hands on again. That was kind of a seasonal thing.
I remember drinking that. It was good.
The Goose Island Sophie. The Ninkasi Hop Cooler Citrus IPA, which I can't say I remember too well anymore. Then a Spencer Trappist, a different type of Belgian ale that I tried while I was in Boston. That was really good.
Okay. Have you been to the Flying Bike Brewery? Did you go there?
Yeah, I went there with you a couple times.
Okay, so it's a co-op brewery. It's in North Seattle in the Greenwood area, right? And they make a grapefruit IPA, which I think might be better than Grapefruit Sculpin.
So I rated that an 8.5.
Oh, for the zest appeal?
Yes. We were talking with our cousin, loyal listener Chris, at Christmas, and he talked about how he was kind of concerned that the Flying Bike Grapefruit IPA didn't score as high as the Ballast Point Grapefruit Sculpin.
Like, and it was like, I've got a lot of concerns here.
Fear not. Like, it's really good. It's just Ballast Point Sculpin, Grapefruit Sculpin, is way up here in my mind.
Okay, so I was there earlier this week. I was there yesterday.
Yes.
And had that beer, and I'm feeling like I'm drinking this. It's fine. This is not a perfect 10 beer to me.
I feel like it can't be a perfect 10 on December 27th.
This is a perfect 10. It's really 10. Not even close. It's like a 6.5 right now.
It's a perfect 10 on like July 27th.
Yeah.
If we shift this in exact 6 months to June 27th, it'll probably be, you know, at least like a 9, 9.5. But beer is very situational.
Beer is really, that's what I was saying about Rainier. Like, you had all those 23 beers or 23 Rainiers that you had this year. And I bet every single one of them tasted completely different.
I don't know if I would go that far, but yes, there were a wide variety, and it mostly was conditioned on whether it was in the purple Jubilee can or not.
Yeah, it tastes a lot better if it's in a purple can.
It's a fact.
But I would like, okay, so I was there yesterday, and I had the Zest Appeal, and I thought it was great. And we're talking December 26th.
That's pretty good.
It tasted really good, but it's fresh from the tap, I understand. Yes.
It also didn't just get dropped outside when the six-pack I had broke on your lawn.
Yeah, are we drinking all of these? Because if so, challenge accepted. But I think we should get a growler of the Zest Appeal IPA, Grapefruit IPA, from Flying Bike and do a head-to-head comparison between that and the Ballast Point Grapefruit Sculpin, maybe even a blind taste test.
First off, you know I cannot refuse a blind taste test.
You had me a blind taste test.
Exactly. So I'm in. Let's do this.
We're not doing nearly enough blind taste tests.
We're not. We're going to really have to step our game up.
We should. Okay, if we have time to do it this week, if any of us is anywhere near the Greenwood neighborhood, we have to get a growler. Are you going anywhere near Greenwood? You're heading to Portland, right?
I mean, I'm going to the Husky basketball game, but that's on New Year's Day. I don't know if they'll be open then after the Husky basketball game. We'll see. We'll figure something out.
Because
it doesn't have to be this week also.
I'm ready for it right now. I'm so mad that we don't have the Zestapeel flying bike.
Well, if you would have thought ahead.
I didn't know. Well, I also didn't have a growler with me.
Yeah.
But I would like to compare those two, because I'm pretty sure that's a better beer than this, and I'm curious to see how you rate it.
I would rate it a new time.
But I'm going to make the same resolution. I'm going to roll the resolution back and make the same resolution for 2017, and we can check in on our beer stats throughout the year.
Yeah, I think that'd be good.
You're keeping track in a spreadsheet?
It's on a Google Doc.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the best way. I'm still looking for the most efficient way, because I had to move it to Excel to do all this analysis. It's way easier there.
Yeah. From a Google Doc?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll figure it out. Every time I was doing it, people would always bring up some app that people use. Are you familiar with this?
I am not.
Yeah, we have to figure out what this app is and see if it's actually worthwhile.
I mean, it might be easier for you. I feel like I could do this, and it allowed me to rate the beer and analyze it as I wanted to.
Okay. Yeah, this beer, I don't know. This is like it's like an 8.
Wow.
It's a solid 8. It's just not the perfect beer. I mean, maybe I'm not that as into grapefruit as much as you are.
You're not.
I like grapefruit. Even I find the Sculpin, maybe it's just too readily available. I can taste how easy this was to get.
I don't know what the name is of that bias or that effect.
It's hipster biased.
Yeah, that's what it should be if it isn't.
Is that not an official term?
I don't know if it is.
Okay, I'm coining that right now.
Or the hipster effect.
Yeah, the hipster effect. But you can just taste how easily attainable it is. Should we talk Husky? Naturally, we're going to talk Husky football quite a bit.
Yeah, we're saving that for the end.
Are we?
Yeah.
We're talking Seahawks before then?
We should, yes.
Do we have to?
Yes. Husky basketball. I attended my first Husky game of the season last Thursday at Key Arena as they defeated Seattle University 94-72
in the Battle of Seattle. So you haven't been to a Husky home game yet?
I have not been to it. Yeah, no, I have not. I anticipate going on Sunday.
You only go to games at Key Arena.
So, random story. I happened to be introduced to Will Conroy, which I think was the second time I've been introduced to Will Conroy, but that's neither
here nor there. How dare he not remember you?
Yeah, I know. That was your... And so, I was...
I feel like that was actually what you were trying to say. It's like, oh, Will Conroy should remember me.
That was not what I was trying to say.
Okay.
He should not remember... A, he should not remember me, and B, like, he was introduced to me by someone else who was implying that he didn't know me. So, like, you just go along with it in that situation.
Yes, 100%.
Unless you really know that you know the person. Anyways, he heard that I was, like, an NBA reporter for ESPN. He was like, oh, you only go to the games at Key Arena. And I, like, that was true this year. It was true so far.
Well, me and Will Connor had the same thought.
Yeah.
You should have invited him on the pod.
I didn't even think of it.
Hey, maybe he likes grapefruit Sculpin. Maybe he's been rating the beers that he's been drinking throughout the whole year. He could have told us what he was drinking.
Something tells me he isn't, just because he's not me.
Because basically nobody else is. Yes. I bet JJ Redick is.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's drinking a lot more Shinerbach than we are, though.
Probably.
Anyway.
So this was the last game of non-conference play for the Huskies, who now will open up Pac-12 play on Sunday against the rival Wazoo Cougars at Hecka Nissen Pavilion. So it was another game where the Husky defense was pretty strong in the second half, where they really pulled away. This was Seattle U led this game early. Markel Fultz picked up a couple of early fouls. The offense wasn't really clicking. Then when he was on the bench, David Crisp hit a couple threes, started playmaking. He ended up with a career-high 7 assists. He got it going. Noah Dickerson had probably the best game of his career, had a double-double and a career-high 17 rebounds, I believe. I want to say 23 points. So it was really a feel-good performance by the Huskies going into this break before they start conference play.
What did the offense look like? Because last game we were talking about Romar was playing a little bit smaller than he was previously. Did they do any of that against Seattle U?
No.
No, completely forgot about it.
Oddly enough, they didn't. I mean, in this case, I think what they liked is Dickerson really had a matchup advantage on the block as a power forward. Would have been tougher for him as a center.
Okay.
Going against... Part of what happened was Seattle U's 7-3 center, Aaron Menzies, got in foul trouble early in the second half, and they just didn't have much without him.
Hmm.
But the offense, you know, again, the Huskies are, I think, fourth in the nation in three-point percentage so far this season, which is really hard to understand.
Why they're not better?
Why they're not better? Or like, yeah.
Given that they are the fourth in the nation in 3-point percentage.
Excuse me, second in the nation at 43.4%.
Is it just because their defense is so bad?
Yeah, I mean, the offense is top 40 in the country. Like, the offense is pretty good. The defense is 214th.
It's funny because when you watch the games, you don't feel like the offense is that good.
No.
It kind of seems like everything's bad.
But this is actually the best offense since the last NCAA tournament team.
Really?
Yeah, so it's better than the Roten team, better than last year's team with Marquise Chriss and DeJounte Murray, all of those. It's been better offensively. It's just been so the worst defensive team in Ken Pomeroy history for the Huskies.
So going into Pac-12 play, do you feel like the team is maturing a little bit? Because you've talked about experience being the most important factor for the Huskies so far. Do you feel like you're seeing that happen? And do you feel like defense is something that could potentially come along throughout the year?
I do. I mean, I've mentioned that I think there's a comparison between this team and I think that was 2013-14, which was the year that the Huskies had very limited depth inside. Sean Kemp Jr. was dealing with Graves' disease and had limited stamina at that point. Desmond Simmons had knee surgery. Gerard Giroux tore his ACL in the opening game. And they basically just had Paris Blackwell.
You're just listing off ailments.
Yes. I'm just making these up as I go. I've drawn the
map. Who had plantar fasciitis?
By the way, that year they were about equally bad defensively in the non-conference, and it looked like they were just going to be the worst Husky team of the Romar era since his first year. And then lo and behold, they started conference play with a stretch where opponents just could not make a three to save their lives, and like started out, I think, like 4-2 that year.
That was the year where we were feeling like we might make the tournament, and then things kind of fell off the bus.
Well, it was more the next year, I think, was like that, when Robert Upshaw, they were not undefeated in most of non-conference play, and then Upshaw got dismissed from the program early in conference play, and the team completely collapsed. And that actually was the worst of the Romar teams, despite starting out so well. But this team started out 3-1 in conference play, and then also 5-3, and they weren't really playing that much better. They just had really good three-point luck. This team has had really poor three-point luck thus far, allowing opponents to make 39.8%.
The team that's second in the nation has had poor three-point luck?
On the defensive end.
Okay.
Because, you know, they're going to regress to the mean, surely, somewhat, in terms of their own three-point percentage, but you have control over that. That's a skill. Defensive three-point percentage is not a skill.
Okay. I don't understand how those two things can be true at the same time.
Because whether I make a shot is more contingent on my shooting ability than how well you defend the shot.
Okay.
As much as people like talk about open threes and contested threes, basically the main thing you can do defensively with threes is keep opponents from shooting them in the first place. And those guys are actually doing a pretty good job of that. They're 75th of that. I mean, they're not, you know, that's not elite, but it's
doing a pretty good, being 75th is a pretty good job, right? Our standards are very low.
Compared to being 214th overall in defense, that's pretty good.
God. So what about Wazoo quickly?
Yeah, Wazoo is not good. The Ernie Kent experiment so far has not gone particularly well. They went 7-5 in non-conference play, lost two games at home to sub-200 teams in the Ken Pomeroy rankings.
How many do the Huskies lose at home to sub-200 teams?
Oh, wait, no, I've got that wrong, Dad. The Huskies did not lose any. None of the teams they faced were that, or they lost to were that bad.
Great.
I mean, one thing I will say, the teams the Huskies lost to, not that bad. I mean, Nevada's 76th now. Yale was the one. TCU's up to 37th.
Yeah, TCU's going to be good. We knew you had me at Jamie Dixon with TCU.
Exactly. Yeah. Yale is the one game that was actually an embarrassing loss. TCU went 11-1 in non-conference.
Yeah, TCU's
Yale
good.
Is the one game that was actually an embarrassing non-conference loss. They're at 110th went 6-5 in non-conference play. God.
Okay. But they're not sub-200. They're Orleans, who I've never heard of.
No. Never heard of New Orleans?
I mean, I've heard of the city.
That's the alma mater of Irvin Johnson, the former Sonic Center.
Really?
New Orleans. So they are ranked 260th. They also lost to San Jose State, who is ranked 209th. The one encouraging performance Wazoo had was... actually, I'm not sure here.
Didn't happen. Was in practice one time.
They crushed Montana pretty well. They beat Montana by 24, so I guess that was pretty impressive. Yeah, I mean, they're...
Who was it who they were playing last week? I kept seeing repeated over and over again, like Santa Clara.
Yeah, they beat Santa Clara by one at home.
Yeah, it was a very close game with Santa Clara.
And Santa Clara is on the fringe of 200. They're 197 in the country. So the Cougars are only marginally better than the Huskies defensively. They force almost no turnovers, like a shockingly low amount of turnovers. And in good news for the Huskies, they never get any offensive rebounds.
Really?
So their star is senior Josh Hawkinson, a guy from this side of the mountains who wasn't really considered a good enough athlete to go to UW, but has developed into a pretty nice college player, reasonably high percentage shooter, gets to the free throw line a lot, which is something the Huskies will want to take away, a great defensive rebounder, not much of a rim protector, which is, I think, you know, another weakness for the Cougs. If the Huskies can get to the basket, you know, they'll be effective.
What time is this game?
5:30 on Sunday.
Okay, that's not terrible timing.
Yeah, on New Year's Day. So the Huskies want to keep Hawkinson off the free throw line. And then the other thing they can take advantage of is the Cougars are really small in the perimeter. They sometimes play together three guards, 6 foot Charles Callison, 6'1 Malachi Flynn, and 6'2 Ike Arebu, who does play a little bit bigger than his size. Flynn has actually been a really pleasant surprise for them. He's a guy who signed late last year out of Bellarmine Prep in Tacoma, won the state 4A championship last year. He was previously committed to Pacific, and all his offers basically were like West Coast Conference, you know, some WAC, some Big Sky even. And they ended up signing him, and he's shooting 46.5% on threes and 56% on twos.
Really?
But this team also gives up a lot of threes, which is good news for the Huskies if they keep shooting anywhere near what they have been lately. If the Huskies don't win this game easily, it will be a major concern. Okay. I mean, not easily. I mean, comfortably, let's say.
So given that, what is the percentage chance of victory?
I would say about 85.
That seems about right.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be nice to start the season with a victory, especially over Wazoo.
Well, let's not get too crazy.
If they can.
The schedule does set up pretty favorably at the start because the Huskies are home for their first three. And then after Wazoo, it's Oregon, who will obviously be a major challenge. But then Oregon State, who is the weakest team in the Pac-12 at this point.
So they play the two worst teams in the Pac-12 within their first three games.
Yes. Oregon State and Wazoo are right next to each other in the rankings. They're both outside the top 200.
Oh, great. This is the option for that top 200 home loss for the Huskies.
Yeah, there you go. That's the possibility.
You know, it looks like a potentially good start to the season that could help them ease into conference play.
Yeah. We should talk quickly about the Husky UW women who did start conference play tonight and beat the Cougars 94-63.
Nice. That's a lot of points.
That is a lot of points. The Cougars actually had come off their previous game they played at Kentucky, who is a perennial power, ranked number 8 in the RPI right now, and lost that by 2 points.
Huh.
So this is, they're not that good overall, but it's still impressive for the Huskies to dominate them so thoroughly in their Pac-12 opener, and they'll be on the road this weekend against the Oregon schools.
Should we talk Seahawks quickly?
We should.
If we have to.
I'm not over it because...
I'm not over it at all.
The loss is devastating for the Seahawks' chances of getting the number 2 seed.
Yes.
And having a clear path to the NFC Championship game. Uh-huh.
To losing to the Cowboys.
Yes. The path is now muddied significantly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it happens. Like, I mean, freaking out about this one loss to me is crazy. Like, this game, as I mentioned on Twitter, I think, eerily similar to the 2013 game they lost to the Cardinals at home in Week 16. And that team went on to win the Super Bowl.
Like you didn't know if you tweeted that. In between all your pizza, Pachulia jokes, you don't know what came out.
I contemplated tweeting it. I think I tweeted
You at least thought about tweeting it. You went all the way with the Zaza content. You think that this game was eerily similar to that?
Yes, in terms of there was, you know, a touchdown where a number 2 cornerback got beat late in the game for a touchdown that was seemingly backbreaking, the inability of the offense to get anything going, the pressure of the defense.
Why don't I remember this game at all?
I don't know.
Where
you
was
were
I?
There. You may have drank a lot before that one. You were not recording the beers you were drinking ahead of that one.
That game is such a mystery to me. Is that the game where you dropped us off? You dropped me and Chris off? I saw that was a Rams game, but it may have been a Cardinals game.
I mean, that's possible.
Do you remember that? It was pouring rain. It was just a really gross rainy day.
And it was right before Christmas. It was the same thing as this.
And you dropped us off. I think it was that game. And I remember
the Seahawks lost that. I mean, that was a lower scoring.
It was
game.
Really close, low scoring.
17-10.
I think that it might, and I think Russell maybe had a drive at the end of the game that was really terrible, and he might have ended on a pick. Is that right?
That sounds right.
I think I just thought that was against the Rams because it felt like a Rams game.
It was not against the Rams. The Seahawks beat the Rams the next week to solidify the number one seed. So that's the big difference here is in that case,
exactly.
The Seahawks could afford that loss and still be the number one seed. Yes, Carlos Dansby with an interception.
Okay, so I do remember that game. I just always had thought that was a Rams game.
Okay.
It really felt like a Rams game.
It was a Michael Floyd 31-yard touchdown after the Seahawks had come back to, I believe, tie the game. Because they lost by, yeah, they had come back to tie the game in the fourth quarter on their second-to-last drive at 10, and then Arizona marched down the field and scored the winning touchdown.
But the difference in that game between that game and this game is the magnitude.
Yes.
Whereas in that one, we knew that we had the opportunity to win the next one. It's like the loss to the Packers this year. It was yes. Like, okay, you can lose this and still get the number two seed and be in a pretty good position. But the magnitude of this loss was so huge because now all of a sudden, instead of looking at one playoff game to go to the NFC Championship game, you're looking at one playoff game against maybe a pretty good team, depending on who it ends up being. Hopefully the Lions. We'll talk about that in a second. And then getting throttled by somebody on the road.
Yes.
They're not going into Atlanta and winning.
I mean, I don't know that I would rule it out. So here's a question I was thinking about today. Are we underrating the loss of CJ Procise? Are we not talking about that enough?
Oh, I'm talking about it.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't actually talked about it, but I'm thinking about it.
Okay, but now we're talking about it.
Okay, when I look at the box, there's so many things to say.
Okay.
I feel like this loss is still so fresh. I wish we would have talked about it right after. I mean, it wasn't the kind of game that warranted an urgent pod, especially on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, it would be really great. Hey, kids, play quietly. We're recording a podcast.
But it just stings so bad, this loss. And the game that it reminded me the most of is the game that I come back to, which feels like the most important game in Seahawks history to me.
I know what you're going to say.
Is the loss at Atlanta.
Yes.
Right? That was the game where the defense couldn't make a stop when you needed them to, right?
Yep.
The offense played pretty badly in the first half, came out in the second half, got it together. You're like, yeah, that's the offense. We're feeling good. You're fired up. At the end of this game, before the block extra point, which we all knew was coming, Before the missed extra point, which we all knew was coming, you're feeling pretty good. You're thinking, okay, Bruce Arians was kind of a dick at halftime saying we've dominated their line for the last 4 years.
3 years, but that was factually incorrect anyway.
Yeah, I don't think he remembers some of those games. When we went into Arizona, beast mode diving into the
which
end zone.
Weird, by the way. So the Seahawks, and I guess this is the last four
years.
But they
the Rams.
The last 4 years against Arizona, the Seahawks are 3-0-1 in Arizona, and they're 1-3 in Seattle against the Cardinals.
It's exceedingly odd. It reminded me of the playoff loss at Atlanta in 2012.
Yeah, I don't know if you actually said that.
Okay. That game was the game where you needed the defense to come up with a stop, and they were so incapable of it. And after that, John and Pete went out and said, we need an answer. And that's when they got Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett.
They did.
Right? They knew that something was wrong, and that's what this team looks like right now. They need an answer, which the answer may be Earl Thomas.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing here is this year's team is substantially worse in terms of pass defense DVOA than that team, as Shiel Kapadia of ESPN tweeted about today.
Oh, that was, I mean, they were number one in DVOA team. This ain't no number one in TVOA team here.
It is not. The streak, we've already lamented it. Now it's been... it's already been eulogized. Everything has happened to this that could possibly happen to the DVOA streak, and I miss it already. But, I mean, the time that Earl Thomas was missed was probably not really on that final drive. It was on the J.J. Nelson 80-yard touchdown pass where Stephen Terrell was completely out of position to make a play.
Yes. And it really throughout the game, this is the first game where I think it was really felt.
I mean, again, you know, it's interesting because, and I think this is along the lines of what I suggested, you know, when we first discussed this issue, is that 95% of the time, probably, the Seahawks don't miss Earl Thomas because Stephen Terrell is just not involved in the play or does his job. But it's that 5% is a really big 5% because it's a long play that is a game-changing play. It's tough to reconcile.
Yes. It could mean an 80-yard touchdown.
Yeah. Which ultimately, you know,
most of the time, it doesn't mean an 80-yard touchdown, but sometimes it does.
Well, sometimes, you know, against the Rams, as we talked about. I think that was what, Farrell Cooper, who dropped that long pass.
Yes,
where he got open deep. So
where we could have missed Earl Thomas.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the 3-point thing, where you want to prevent that play from happening in the first place, but once it does happen, you don't have any control over whether it goes for a touchdown or not. It's really about whether the offense can make the play.
Yeah. Well, good news. The Seahawks are only going to play one more game after this weekend without Earl Thomas.
I don't know about that.
They could play the Lions.
We talked about talking precise, and then we didn't talk about precise.
Okay. So I've been thinking about it. And really, when I look at the box score to this last game, the Seahawks outgained the Cardinals, right? I'm just looking for what the issue was. And the only things that stood out to me, there were three things that stood out to me.
Because their two halves were completely different in this game.
Which is a Seahawks thing. We've seen that a lot. That Falcons game, Carolina last year in the playoffs.
I don't know, that might be an everyone thing.
But they have played games where the offense looks perfect in the second half.
Yes.
And can't do anything in the first half. It's never like, oh, wow, the offense played perfect in the first half and couldn't get anything done in the second half. That's not it. Sometimes the offense comes out cold. So number one was sacks, right? Naturally, Russell was sacked a lot.
Yes.
Number two was how bad Thomas Rawls was.
It was not a great game for Thomas Rawls.
So, I mean, you miss Procise, but then there's the miscommunication with Marcel Reese. There's Rawls running 8 carries for 8 yards. And then the offense finally gets going, which maybe it would have if Rawls was out there in the second half either way. But it finally gets going with Alex Collins. Imagine if Procise was there that whole time.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is the Seahawks have not found an effective third down back. Marcel Reese, you know, might become that guy.
He's
with
not
more
really
time,
a third down
reps.
Back, and he's been here for 3 weeks.
He is a third down back. I dispute that he's not really a third down back. I mean, we did see in that 2-point conversion play that he's excellent catching the ball out of the backfield.
Nice. Yeah,
is befits a guy who's a wide receiver at UW, and is capable in blitz pickup, and then enough of a threat on the ground to be an effective third down back. But he's played with Russell Wilson for 3 weeks in his life.
Yes.
Procise had developed a lot better chemistry, and the timing on a lot of the passes that they had out of the backfield against New England, I don't think it's a coincidence that the best the Seahawks have played all year was at New England, and I think the first and against Philadelphia.
Against Philadelphia, when Procise had the long run.
Right, which was when Procise was healthy and productive.
It's every year we have these amazing running backs. I mean, Rawls last year, why did he have to get hurt? And then Procise the next year.
I mean, I think there are teams that have a lot worse.
Sure. I mean, the Seahawks are really, all things considered, not that injured. But those are such a crucial position.
And his Tyler Lockett injury was such a bummer, though.
It was a bummer, but I mean, you saw in the second half, we're going to see a lot of Paul Richardson, Jermaine Kearse back in the starting lineup. I think that the Seahawks can move past Tyler Lockett. But a running back is different.
Well, hopefully Procise will be back.
How many weeks?
They say he'll be evaluated at the start of the
postseason. Really be nice to have a bye.
It really would be, which there's still a chance.
So the third thing that stood out to me, I want to say this, was explosive plays.
Yeah.
Arizona, I think, had 7 explosive plays against us in that game, some of which coming at just such gut-busting time periods. I mean, happening on the final drive, the little dump-off to David Johnson that ends up going for something like 33 yards, where you're like, okay, that's just too much.
29
yards. It's too much. There's no reason that they should have given up that much. And I think that if we're going to assign blame to the defense, I don't want to just say Stephen Terrell.
No, right? Absolutely not.
Because I think it was a bad game all around. I mean, Stephen Terrell was not... Earl Thomas wouldn't have been the one stopping David Johnson.
I mean, he also had an extended period out there where they had neither Earl nor Cam out there.
Yeah, that's the
first in Seahawks, like, modern history.
Yeah, that's the worst scenario.
And I don't know if Cam was 100% once he got back out there. I mean, he had some nice plays, I think, on that... Let's see, on that play where they forced a 3-and-out and were able to get the ball back, I think Cam had a big stop on that one. Yeah, 2-yard loss for David Johnson on first down on that series. But he also was the guy. Was he in coverage on that David Johnson 29-yard catch? He had the tackle.
Yeah, I think he was in coverage.
Okay.
But, I mean, Cam Chancellor is not necessarily supposed to be the coverage safety.
Right. I mean, the Seahawks have always had trouble covering running backs out of the backfield.
There's so many frustrating things about this game, and they finally came back. They had to fight and scrape and finally got there, and then boom! Arizona comes down with the drive. It actually is kind of, we knew it was happening because it's happened to the Seahawks a lot.
Yeah. For a team that prides itself on defense, getting one final stop is not always happening.
They just give up that drive. And you remember Peyton Manning a couple of years ago came down in like 13 seconds and scored a touchdown?
I do recall that. There was some switch verticals involved. It was bad. The one time they did get that stop was against Atlanta. When the uncalled pass interference on Julio Jones.
I mean, so I mean,
they also did it against New England. They also had the goal line stand, obviously, to win that game.
But they did let them get to the 1 yard line. So anyway, it's not like we knew what was coming when we were in that situation. We knew that the Seahawks scored too early. We knew it was coming, and it happened.
But here's the one, I guess, good thing of the way it happened is the Seahawks lost as a team. The offense was bad for a half. The defense was bad for a half.
I guess
I'm sick of this trying to assign blame and pitting one side of the ball or one player.
Oh my God, the TV broadcast on Richard Sherman every time they got to the goal line, as if Richard Sherman would be holding a sign for what they should be calling. Right? Like he'd have like the college sideline with like animated cartoon characters and an Oregon logo.
That sequence at the 1 yard line, though, like this is officially becoming a thing. It's becoming a mental block at this point for the
Seahawks. I don't think so. They're just a bad team for the 1 yard line. They're a really bad team at getting 1 yard.
It's so bizarre. I don't get it. It makes no sense. They had Marshawn Lynch. In theory, Marshawn Lynch should be the absolute best running back in that situation. And he wasn't that good from the 1 yard line.
We've talked a little bit about, you watch Tom Brady, right? And some of these bigger quarterbacks just get a yard with the quarterback sneak.
Oh, that Russell's
quarterback sneak was, I was like, okay, that's why they don't do it.
I mean, the offensive line also got blown up, is a friend of the pod, loyal listener, Ben B tweeted about today.
About how badly the line got blown up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Russell didn't really stand a chance, but he just didn't look comfortable doing it either.
It's just not what it's not a Russell thing. Russell needs to be, he's like the playmaking midfielder in soccer who can only operate in space. And then when he comes to the MLS and they close him down, like Freddie Ljungberg when he came here, like then he's got nothing. I'm good. I'm done. I'm good.
His extension was pretty bad. I mean, that's one place where Russell's height actually is a factor.
Yes.
Which, whatever, we don't need to do that. We should be able to pick up a yard. And picking up a yard is more about the line than it is about the person running it.
I mean, I feel like this is one of those things where if you're the Seahawks, you spend the offseason like working on these special projects. Scoring for the 1 yard line should be like the only thing Daryl Bevel and the rest of the offensive staff should work on this offseason.
I was feeling really frustrated with
until
the offensive
Daryl Bevel
line.
Was hired by the Bills, apparently.
Is that where he's going?
No, I don't. I mean, he's going to get an interview, it sounds like.
Anthony Lynn's the coach.
How quickly did that guy get promoted? He's like is that the Peter principle, like the ultimate example of it?
I was
the
thinking
team is
about
bad, so he keeps getting promoted because everyone above him gets fired?
No, he's good.
I mean,
he did a very
nice job with their offense. He earned that opportunity. It's funny.
They were talking about Dirk Cutter, right? Dirk Cutter became the Tampa Bay head coach because they didn't want to lose him, which seems baffling to us who have watched him in the Pac-12. But but Anthony Lynn rose from, was he the running backs coach? To offensive coordinator to head coach within the year.
Yeah, that's got to be unprecedented.
I mean, Jim Zorn did it in one offseason.
But he only went, like, he didn't go, like, one step at a time.
No, he did. He was hired as the offensive coordinator at Washington. And then they were like, just be the coach.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
That was more impressive because he did that without doing anything. Anyway, let's talk about the 49ers for a second.
More big picture question is,
okay,
are you worried about Steven Hauschka? I'm pretty worried about Steven.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel like kicking is pretty mental, and now he's got a lot of misses under his belt.
Especially, I don't know, maybe hopefully it'll just be like an Arizona thing.
That's what I actually am hoping that also.
But you see what happened to Blair Walsh after his miss against the Seahawks in the playoffs, and that concerns me.
It was a bigger stage.
The good news here is like,
is that he's a kicker and it doesn't really matter.
No, the good news here is that his missed extra point at the end of the game ultimately did not.
Oh
matter
yeah,
whatsoever.
Nobody was talking about it. Yeah. It's nothing.
Yeah. So yeah. That's the upside of the Seahawks defense.
But you know how I was just thinking about it. Let's say that we're in a playoff scenario, the Seahawks are down 2. And we have a relatively easy Steven Hauschka field goal. I'm not thinking that we're going to win the game easily.
I would agree with that. But here's the thing about Pete Carroll. The best and worst thing about Pete Carroll is he is so relentlessly optimistic and faithful in his players that it will not even cross his mind to go for it more because Hauschka is struggling.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Not even a thought. The 49ers.
Yeah, let's talk briefly about the 49ers.
If the Seahawks don't win this game, it's going to be really dark. That's... That's the main takeaway here. The Niners did beat the LA Rams last Sunday, 22-21, which had the glorious effect of ensuring that barring a Cleveland victory this weekend, they will not get the number one pick in the
draft. I can't believe that win.
Even when they win, they lose.
The worst win in NFL history.
It's not the worst win. It's not a year where you like need to
have where there's clearly a top player, but the Rams are...
It's not like the difference between, say, Drew Bledsoe and Rick Meyer. Not that kind of a draft.
The 49ers are pretty much bad at everything. But let's start when they're with the ball.
They are, but they're good at one thing, and that's running the football. Because it turns out Carlos Hyde has been a top five running back in the NFL this year by DVOA. Would you have imagined that?
I might have imagined that.
Now here's the bad news. Carlos Hyde is out for the year, and they'll be using DeJuan Harris and Sean Drone as their running backs this week.
And then obviously Colin Kaepernick has been terrific running the football. He's kind of gotten back to his roots there. Chip Kelly, as we know, if the man can do one thing, it's drive off talented players from Philadelphia. And if he can do two things, it's drive off talented players from Philadelphia and design a pretty good run offense.
He can't meet with boosters, though. Yeah. Don't ask him to meet with boosters.
When they pass the football, that hasn't gone super great. The 49ers have three of the bottom five receivers in the NFL by Football Outsiders DR. And a fun fact, the bottom five are all from the NFC West.
Curse, definitely.
And our
Tavon Austin.
Tavon Austin, as you like to call it, Tavon Austin territory.
Yeah.
He is obviously last.
He's now in the cursed Austinville. It's only been 1 year for Curse. We won't call it that yet.
Here's the thing about the 49ers defense. They're not good at anything. They're like really bad at stopping the run, but I think that's mostly because teams run a lot against them because teams are ahead.
Oh, no, they're bad at stopping the run.
I mean, they're giving up 5 yards per carry.
I've played fantasy players against the 49ers. They're bad at stopping the run.
But by DVOA, they're 28th against the pass and 29th against the run.
Amazing.
So they're almost equally inept in both categories. Yeah, so and basically all of their good players are injured now.
That's why it'll be a big question who's going to be the running back for the Seahawks going into this game.
Yes, from a fantasy perspective.
Well, in any perspective. I mean, the Seahawks right now are working out running backs off the street to be their backup running back. It's Alex Collins and...
Well, there was guys they signed last week who I should probably know their names, but I got
some guys. Out. It's going to be... Remember Stephen Ridley?
When was the last time you thought of him? It's been a while.
He was a good player in the Patriots in like 2010. And they're currently working him out. I mean, it's if Rawls doesn't play in this game, which I'm not holding my breath that he's going to, I think we go into the game with Alex Collins as the starter and see a heavy dose of him. Collins is going over 100 yards.
I would tend to agree, which is why I have a waiver claim in for him. by the way.
We're toasting to this?
Toasting to a return of Kaysen Williams to the roster.
Oh, hello.
Yeah. Just feels nice to have another dog on the roster. Let's see. The running back that the Seahawks signed last week, J.D. McKissick, who's in line for return.
You could have named 5 random names and asked me to pick one out, and I would not have picked out J.D. McKissick.
He will apparently be sharing return duties with Paul Richardson, with Tyler Lockett out of the lineup, and then Terrence McGee. Terrence McGee.
Okay.
So there you go. Impress your friends with that trivia.
So they're terrible at running the ball, terrible at stopping the run, and terrible at stopping the pass.
Yeah. Oh, but they're not that good at special teams either. So the 49ers are awful. If the Seahawks don't win this game comfortably, it's a bad sign.
It'll be interesting to see how we monitor this between the Seahawks game and the game that we're going to really care about, which is Saints-Falcons.
Yes. We're big, enormous Saints fans for the week.
Huge Saints fans.
I've always loved Drew Brees. I've always spelled the word go, G-E-A-U-X.
Oh, yeah. Who dat?
but there's a few things we're going to have to monitor. I mean, this is not at the same time, but the other game that's going to have a significant impact potentially on the Seahawks, and at that point, the Washington Professional Football Team at that point against the New York Giants will determine whether they make the playoffs as the 6th seed and then the likely opponent if the Seahawks do end up the 3 seed, or if that ends up being the loser of the Detroit-Green Bay game on Sunday Night Football.
So it's a complicated list of things that we're cheering for, again.
Yes.
Because the number one thing that we're cheering... Well, Seahawks winning, number one.
Yes.
Again, this is just in order ranking of things that we're cheering for. Last week it involved Eli Manning in a game at Philadelphia, which we just knew he wasn't winning.
Someone replied to the PeltonCast Twitter about that, and they were dead on.
It wasn't happening. I didn't even hold my breath. They had like a nice drive at the end of the game. It's like, it's not happening. But so Seahawks winning is number one. Saints winning is number two. Number three is a complicated scenario because the Lions are worse than Washington is.
Yes.
We want nothing to do with the Packers.
Yes.
We'd rather play the Lions, but Washington wouldn't be bad. So because of timing, we're probably cheering for Washington. And then we're cheering for Detroit. However, if Washington loses, then we're cheering for Green Bay.
Yes, because then Green Bay would be the four seed and unlikely to play the Seahawks at any point. I think at that point they would only be able to play in the conference championship. But I mean, it also kind of hinges on the result of the New Orleans-Atlanta game a little while. But if the Seahawks are locked in the three seed, the worst thing that can happen is for Green Bay to end up the sixth seed and come to Seattle that first weekend.
Which you just feel like it's coming, don't you?
Do you? I don't feel that.
I mean, it might be kind of fun. I don't know. It might be kind of fun having Green Bay.
Do you think Detroit is going to beat Green Bay?
I think they could beat Green Bay.
I mean, obviously they could. It's the NFL. One team can beat another team.
No, they're not beating Green Bay.
But I think it's exceedingly unlikely.
But it's interesting to look at the different scenarios and kind of rank. I'm still going to be cheering for Washington because I don't mind them coming here.
I agree with that.
At the same time, obviously, we're cheering for New Orleans.
It's going to be hard to do an entire podcast without saying their name, but, you know, I think we can pull it off.
And also, we've seen Washington in the playoffs. It's gone fine.
Who was the quarterback for them in that year?
Well, there were a couple times. There was RG3.
Oh, right. That was in D.C. But I meant the game they played in Seattle, where it was like a washed-up veteran quarterback who started that game.
Man, I want to say Brad Johnson.
No, it wasn't Brad Johnson. He is a former Washington quarterback.
Didn't Mark Brunell start a game here?
Probably at some point in his career, but that wasn't who started that playoff game either.
There have been a lot of various quarterbacks. Trent Green. Who was it? Gus Frerotte. I'm just naming names.
Yeah, you are. I'm going to look it up here. We'll have it in a second. Here.
Mark Rypien.
Let's see here. Seahawks won that game 35-14, and the starting quarterback for the Washington in that game was Todd Collins.
Oh, Todd Collins.
He went 29 of 50 for 266 yards, 2 touchdowns, 2 interceptions.
Was he their starter?
I think he took over midseason.
Interesting. Okay, so given all this, percentage chances of victory for the Seahawks?
I mean, it's not a guaranteed victory. I would say like 90%.
I think it's about 85. I'm less confident than you are.
Yeah, that's troubling.
Yeah, things are not going well. Also, given the magnitude, should we do Falcons Saints percentage chance of victory?
Yeah, I'm going to say 80% Falcons.
I was going to go 75. Okay. Those two teams, considering how big of we're not going into this weekend assuming it's a done deal.
No, I mean, just as it wasn't a done deal when the Seahawks played the Cardinals last week, despite the fact that the Cardinals were a weaker team on the road.
A much better team. Like, say, a year ago, they were maybe the best team in the NFL.
Yeah, but so far this year, they've been substantially worse than the Saints have been.
The Saints are a pretty good team.
They're spry.
It's two really good offenses going against each other.
Go into Arizona and beat them a week ago. Things change fast.
No, I mean, the Saints are coming off ending the Buccaneers season.
Yeah.
Going into Arizona and winning. The Saints can win this game. We should not give up hope, despite the fact that I want to give up all hope.
Do not abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Podcast.
Maybe if they get a bye week, CJ Procise will be back and the offense will be fixed.
All right. Should we talk about the most... this is the most important game in Husky football history,
the
right?
The granddaddy of them all. This is the Huskies Rose Bowl.
You can't say that. That's offensive.
As Pac-12 champions, this is what we get. a trip to the Peach Bowl.
I'm still working on support for my post-bowl plus four.
Hey, one at a time. It's never going to happen because they've already gone to a playoff, but
this is a better playoff. It's a better playoff. Anyway, yes, the Huskies in Atlanta preparing to take on number one Alabama.
The most important game of Husky history? I don't think so.
I mean, obviously, Michigan was for a national championship
in the Rose Bowl.
You didn't know that for sure at the time.
You had to wait until the papers came out the next day,
right? Like, that's not a joke. You literally had to do that. I guess it was.
I mean, it is a joke, but that's actually
what happened. It was on radio and TV. I mean, you didn't actually have to wait for like the January 2nd newspaper.
You heard it. Steve Vrabel was still in the NFL at the time, so you didn't hear it from him.
That's not accurate.
It's an important game. One of the maybe three or four most important games.
Is this the best team the Huskies have ever played?
Could be the best team the Huskies have ever played.
I think that's quite possible.
So given the general perspective that this is such an insurmountable game for the Huskies.
The fact that they're a 14-point underdog and were as high as a 16.5-point underdog at one point before the money started coming in on them.
Getting closer.
Yeah. By game time, that could be down all the way to 12.5. I thought we should talk about why this game might be closer than everyone thinks. And I don't know if I'm going to say a path to victory necessarily, but at least a path to a competitive game.
Okay. So how about if we do reasons this game would be closer than you think?
Okay.
Reasons this game is not as close as you think.
Yeah. Well, no, is not close as everyone thinks.
I mean, look, 14 points could be a close game. 14 points could seem like a close game.
It could.
If it's a 40-point loss.
So let's start with ESPN's Football Power Index, which I think is the most favorable.
Are we talking about, we're starting with reasons why this game is closer than you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because if you look at ESPN's Football Power Index, the difference is not 16.5 points. It's not 14 points. It's 5.4 points. That's pretty close.
Yeah.
And if you go by, so that's the version of Football Power Index that includes like the preseason expectations for teams, which is more predictive going forward. But if you look strictly at how they've performed this year, you want to know, okay, number one in the country in terms of performance this year.
Alabama. Yeah.
Number two in the country in terms of performance this year, Washington. Only 2.8 points back. That's like a close to a toss-up at that point, right?
Yeah. I mean, how much? Okay, wait, I want to, what else do you have?
I mean, I think the other main thing to note here is Alabama has been an excellent team. They have destroyed all comers this season. They have not as yet played a team nearly as good as UW. I mean, the best team they've probably played all year statistically is USC, but they played USC at a point when Max Brown was the starting quarterback.
Throw that one out.
We went over when the Huskies lost to USC. The USC with Sam Darnold was a very different team than USC with Max Brown. Then it's LSU, who is number 7 in the country, ranks a lot better by the advanced metrics than their actual 7-4 record. But
it was a close game. They played a close game.
It's not like Alabama, their schedule has been more difficult than UW's because they didn't play a joke of a non-conference schedule like UW did. But
and it's still a beast of a non-conference schedule to get through.
A conference schedule?
Yes.
Yeah, but the Pac-12 is not exactly a bunch of gimmies. UW is going to be the best team Alabama has faced all year.
Yes.
And they have played some close games. They beat LSU 10-0 in a game that set back offensive football a few decades. And then also
played some of those. Yeah, those two teams in particular play some of those.
And then also played a close game against Ole Miss, where they won that one
48-43,
despite the fact that they also played a 19 game against point game against Arkansas, despite the fact that I think that was the one where Arkansas had 5 turnovers in that game.
Our close game that we're pointing to is a 19 point victory.
Yeah, but it's safe to say that the Huskies are probably not going to have 5 turnovers. They've had, I think you have to look at 3 games in a row for them to have 5 turnovers at any point so far this season.
Okay, so FPI says this game is closer than it seems.
Right.
I mean, just as an empirical thing, how much of this has to do with even us thinking, we talk about this game.
Yeah, the Huskies have 2 3 game stretches this year where they have 5 turnovers. They did not have more than 2 in any game.
We talk about this game as if there's almost no chance of the Huskies winning, which I think is a good perspective for us to have going in.
It's a good, yeah. You know, as I like to say, the pessimist is either right or pleasantly surprised.
And I think Chris Peterson is taking that perspective also, which is a great perspective for him to take.
Yes.
But how much of our thinking that this game is so lopsided has to do with the Alabama SEC East Coast bias?
I mean, Alabama is the best team in the country. It's just a question of how much better than everyone else they are. And then a question of where Washington ranks in the country. Because I don't think people nationally still think of UW as the fourth best team.
No.
So that's a factor in it. If it was a typical one versus four matchup, I'm not sure it would be quite this lopsided.
Okay, so what about reasons why this game may be closer looking specifically at Alabama's roster?
Well, I think the first thing, it's funny, there was a really good preview of the game today by Zach Cram on The Ringer, and he talked about how most people, when they're explaining why UW could be close, they really give a bunch of reasons why Alabama is going to win. So I'm going to start there, too.
Wait, what?
Alabama's rushing defense is so good.
That's one of the reasons?
It is amazingly good. They are allowing opponents 2 yards per carry this season.
Yeah.
But their pass defense, it's still sixth in the country. It's still really good, but not quite as good as UW's. It's so you can move the football through the air against Alabama. And a couple of teams have managed to do that so far this season. Those being the aforementioned Mississippi, which lost by a very close game and averaged 10.5 yards per attempt against Alabama, and then Arkansas, which had 8.3 yards per attempt. So those teams were both able to score points, 43 for Ole Miss, 30 for Arkansas. If the Huskies can score that many points, they're going to be competitive in this game.
Absolutely.
And then I think the other thing is Alabama's pass offense, not that good. Jalen Hurts has been the closest match for his passing statistics this year in the Pac-12. Another true freshman, Justin Herbert from Oregon. You don't look at Justin Herbert and be like, oh, that guy's unbeatable. Now, that probably has a lot to do with the rest of the Oregon roster.
Yeah.
But that's, if you, especially.
I don't think the Huskies are going for 70 in this one.
I don't think so.
Either. Bold prediction.
Hot take. If you can get him in third and long, Pro Football Focus had some stats on, you know, Jalen Hurts, when he was under pressure versus not under pressure, his completion percentage drops to 30.6% from 74.6%. His yards per attempt drop from 8.8 to 3.6. And if you just look when situations where he's been blitzed, still only 6.7 yards per attempt, which is pretty poor, all things considered.
So Jalen Hurts, we're talking about reasons this game could be closer.
Yes.
Okay. And so, and somehow you mentioned the Alabama rush defense, which I don't really understand how that fit into the mix.
Because, okay, the Alabama defense is really amazing overall.
That's reasons that this game is not going to be close.
It's more about their rush defense than it is about their pass defense. You can throw the ball on Alabama.
So you look at Alabama's roster.
Sometimes.
And the focal
until they have an interception return for a touchdown.
They don't get as many of those anymore.
They've scored 10 touchdowns on defense this year. That's twice as many as the number three school in the country.
Well, the focal point of their defense is definitely the line, and especially their veteran linebackers.
Yes.
Right?
It's in the front seven.
In that 3-4 system, you've got Tim Williams Sr., Ryan Anderson a senior, Reuben Foster, maybe the best defensive player in the country, or one of them. And then also a D-line that is so veteran, right?
Yeah.
But you look at the secondary, they're not as experienced. But the one place to me that I think could catch up to Alabama is injuries.
That's a good point.
Now, we can talk about this on the Husky side also.
We can.
Huskies don't have the same amount of injuries. And they also, we can talk about depth on the Alabama side too. But at the same time, Alabama's injuries are starting to add up just a little bit. I mean, one of their best defensive players, Eddie Jackson, went down in October. After that, they didn't give up a touchdown for all of November.
Irrelevant.
So he went out. They moved Minka Fitzpatrick to safety to replace him. He responded by leading the team in interceptions.
And returning two of them for touchdowns.
And them not giving up a touchdown in November. At the same time, in the SEC championship game, they lose linebacker Sean Dion Hamilton, yes, who's been a useful linebacker for them. At the same time, they're able to replace him with a veteran junior linebacker. It's like the Huskies have to replace linebackers with freshmen and inexperienced players. Alabama, they've got juniors who've played for the last 3 years to replace their injured players.
I mean, their offense is not nearly as experienced. I mean, you start obviously with Hurts and the fact that he's a true freshman playing the most important game now of his career. It's not the most important game in Alabama history. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that, but it's the most important game of his career. And their running backs are not that experienced. They're all sophomores or freshmen. They're trio of running backs. Their wide receiver core is a little more experienced, but you're not looking at, it's not the same experience level on the offense it is on the defensive side of the football. And this offense, it's okay. It's not bad, but it's not great. It ranks 23rd in the country in FPI efficiency. I mean,
you talked about Jalen Hurts passing the ball.
Yes.
Can the Huskies get them into passing situations?
Maybe. Probably not. I mean, all three of their running backs are averaging at least 6 yards per carry, so they got that going for them, which is nice. If you like that sort of thing.
Okay. No. So no. No. No, I mean, this is a situation where if the Huskies can stop the run, they've been a quality team against the run. And losing Azeem Victor and Joe Mathis doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be that affected against the run. They've still been good since those players went down.
Yes.
They're a little bit more important in other aspects, rushing the passer in places like that.
I mean, the other thing is Alabama has not faced, I said this is the best team they've faced. They have not faced an offense like this all year. The best offense in the SEC was LSU, which ranked 20th in FPI efficiency.
And is a one-dimensional offense.
They did face two stronger offenses in non-conference. USC, 14th overall, but again,
USC game we can't factor in. I really think we have to throw that out.
And then Western Kentucky was 5th in the country in FPI efficiency on offense. So that's apparently adjusted for opponent. So I don't know. I don't know what to tell you there. Also, they're kicking, not that great. Pretty average.
These are the reasons.
They're place kicking.
Their place kicker has been their kicker for four years, right? He's a 4-year starter.
Okay, but he's only made 73.6% of his field goals this year. It's pretty dead on NCAA average. And if you can find a place where Alabama's average, you take advantage of it.
I also want to point out a little bit of their depth. So they lost Dakota Ball. Do you know why they lost him? A defensive lineman, part of their D-line depth, not necessarily a starter.
Okay.
Hunting injury, got shot.
Wait, seriously?
Maybe shot himself.
Did Dick Cheney shoot him?
It's an Alabama injury. But they're losing some depth in a couple of different places. There are places where their defense is having to rely on slightly less experienced players than they previously were. Right? Uh-huh. I mean, you mentioned that secondary. Their secondary is a lot less experienced without Eddie Jackson out there. I mean, you just imagine what they could have done with him.
Yeah.
And then also on the O-line, losing a little bit of depth due to injuries. They lost also in the SEC championship game Josh Casher, one of their starting guards in that game. So some depth adding up for Alabama.
So only good after relying on the Outland Trophy winner, tackle Cam Robinson, who was going to be a first round pick in all likelihood.
The first overall pick?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, those things. But, I mean, you look on the other side, it's a factor for the Huskies because the Huskies don't have that kind of depth.
Have we gotten to that? Are we going over?
Do you have any other reasons why this game is closer than you think?
No, I think that was pretty much it.
I mean, I guess the other reason is that Jake Browning has been very good throughout the year. We're pointing to these couple of games and saying, oh, Jake Browning can't play against really good teams. But Jake Browning, if you look at the overall performance throughout the season, looks like one of the best quarterbacks in the country.
Yes.
We're throwing out so many different things in this game on the Husky side. The only thing we're throwing out on the Alabama side is just this one victory against the USC. But we're throwing out all of Jake Browning's performances through the entire season, scoring 70 points against Oregon, dominating Stanford, and just saying he played badly against USC.
Who didn't score 70 points against Oregon?
Played badly against USC and Colorado in a game that the Huskies still won, I think 41-14. I mean, we shouldn't feel that down on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing to talk about is just the overall balance of the UW team.
Yes.
Top 10 in both defense and offense in terms of FPI. That's much more balanced than Alabama, which is number one in defense and number 23 in offense.
And before we get there, we have to talk about Coach Pete.
So that's an interesting question. Because there's a theory that Coach Pete is amazing when he has time to prepare for games. And I went and looked at the numbers on this. So what I did was compare his performance in bowl games and season openers to the overall ability of the team using Sager and ratings.
Okay.
So, for example, this year's UW team overall has a rating of 98.1. If you look at basically just what they did against Rutgers in the season opener, based on how Rutgers rated home field advantage.
I mean, you're assuming that he spent like all offseason preparing for Rutgers.
But that's the theory, because everyone's like, oh, they beat Georgia and Virginia Tech in the season opener.
And Oregon. Don't forget about Oregon.
Yes, in Oregon. That performance, who else?
Lost to the Huskies.
Yeah, I was going to point that out. That performance rates is an 84.7. So the Huskies were actually significantly better over the course of the season than they were in the season opener against Rutgers. If you go through this through every game in Coach Pete's history, in season openers, his teams have played 1.7 points per game worse than they have overall. Largely because of the last 4 years where, as you noted, they got destroyed by the Huskies in a game where you determined that Coach Pete was a bad coach. You'll recall.
They didn't compete. They're either competing or they're not, and they weren't competing in that game.
I mean, there's some...
I remember them punting, being down like 3 touchdowns in the fourth quarter.
They did do that. There's some mitigating factors here. They had the one-point win at Hawaii in his first game at UW with Jeff Lindquist as the starting quarterback.
That was a bad one.
There was the game at Boise State last year, which was Jake Browning's first game. So not surprising that didn't go super great. But overall, worse in season openers than overall. In bowl games, 2 points per game better than their overall record. But I think the important thing,
almost makes up that difference in FPI that you're talking about for this season.
It does. That's a valid point. But it's really mostly contingent on three games: beating Arizona State by 32 points in 2011, beating Utah by 23 in 2010, and then beating TCU by 7 in 2009 in a showdown of the two best non-Power 5 schools that year.
So this Oklahoma game doesn't factor into that?
Here's the fun fact about the Oklahoma game. Strictly going by the Sager win ratings.
Played badly.
Boise State underperformed in that game. They were favored to win that game by like 5 or 6 points, and they only ended up winning by 1 in overtime.
Coach Pete should be embarrassed.
So everyone like thinks of this, but here's the point, though.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
The point is, Coach Pete, he's pretty good in games where he has time to prepare. But you know when else Coach Pete is good?
What?
When he doesn't have time to prepare. Coach Pete is just good all the time. Okay?
Oh, wow.
Like the reason people think he's really good when he's prepared is because that's the only time they ever watched Boise State play.
Yes, Boise State was just always good.
When they were playing Georgia or Virginia Tech or Oregon in the season opener, or when they were playing this major bowl game. But they were doing that to whack teams too, just no one cared about that. Coach Pete is just really good all the time.
I think there's an inherent bias there where if they beat Nevada or whatever, who's the second best whack team?
When he was there, probably Nevada, when they had Colin Kaepernick.
So if they beat Nevada
a lot of Colin Kaepernick talk in this pod.
35, 40 points, nobody's saying, wow, what a victory.
Exactly, which is why the two highest-rated openers that Coach Pete had in that span were, the Georgia one was up there, but the highest-rated one was beating Weber State by 49 points.
It's a nice win. I remember that one. But that's why this has to be mentioned. I mean, you're saying that he's not necessarily significantly better with time to prepare for teams, but having Coach Pete on our side, which granted they have Nick Saban, okay, that could be a factor for them also. But having Coach Pete on our side as a coach who's going to have the team ready to play.
We've had Coach Pete on our side all year. What you really should be looking at is the fact that the Huskies rating has been really good all year. That's the reason to think this is close. Not because Coach Pete has a magic ability to prepare when he has more time.
Yes. In fact, we've seen his trick plays. They're really not that impressive.
I mean, Dante Pettis is very good at throwing passes, but I don't think that has anything.
Wide receiver pass is not exactly the most brilliant thing that he came up with.
Yes.
A lot of people have thrown wide receiver passes. I mean, that reputation is more or less based off two plays in one game.
It is.
But having a team that is so steady at everything they do, there's no one place where you can look at the Huskies.
That's the thing about Coach Pete, is he's had a decade now, more than a decade. More than a decade, of having to win every game he played.
Yeah.
And that's where I think really came invaluable this UW season. Like, that's a difficult thing to get teams to play at that consistent level and not have a letdown. And that's his strength, not the, again, preparing for one game.
Playing consistent from week to week. We looked at the Seahawks, right? The Seahawks are very variant this year.
Yes.
The Huskies are not a variant team. They play fairly consistent, and they do it on all sides of the ball. And that's what I think Alabama hasn't faced, and that's why I think it will be a tougher test for them than people are saying.
All right, so now let's talk about why this game is not going to be close.
What will not be a tougher test than people are saying?
So what's the number one thing that scares you about UW's defense?
About UW's defense? I guess pass rush?
No, that's the wrong answer.
What's the right answer?
The right answer is running quarterbacks.
Oh, well, yes.
You remember what Brandon Dawkins did to the Huskies?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it turns out Jalen Hurts is that, except if he also could throw. So far this season, Jalen Hurts, if you take out his sacks, he's run the ball 146 times for 937 yards, 6.4 yards per carry.
Oh, no.
That's bad. That's better than Brandon Dawkins, alas. So I can see him moving the chains repeatedly, scrambling out of things. You mentioned the injuries the Huskies have. Their pass rush has not been the same without Joe Mathis.
Yeah.
It did kind of rebound a bit towards the Colorado game, the Wazoo game, the last couple games of the season. Those were encouraging. And I do think one thing we're going to see a lot of in this game, because as I mentioned, Hurts hasn't been as effective against the blitz. Buda Baker blitzing off the edge, we're going to see a lot of that in this game.
So interesting blitzes.
Yes. Okay. I mean, he's been very effective as a blitzer so far this season. But to do that, you have to get Alabama in third and long. And if Hurts is constantly picking up yardage on the ground, and their other running backs who are all effective are doing that, then it's hard to get them in those third and long situations.
That's the thing that, I mean, Jalen Hurts scares me, right? But the other thing that scares me the most is just this trio of running backs gaining 5-6 yards per carry and the Huskies having no answer for it. Imagine the first drive of the game. Alabama gets the ball, churns the field.
Yep.
5 yards at a time, and they easily score a touchdown. How are we going to respond to that? And that is a very likely scenario. I mean, you have running backs who are averaging around 7 yards per carry, and three of them.
Yeah. So the other thing, what were you upset about during the USC game?
The Huskies didn't run the ball enough?
Yes. Do you know how the Huskies ran the ball in that game?
I know.
Because I pulled up the stats on it.
How did they run the ball?
They rushed the ball 27 times for 17 yards.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Now that includes sacks in college football because for some reason they have not figured out that they should count sacks as passing plays. Someday, maybe in 2020, we'll get that. But that's 0.6 yards per carry. That's bad. Hey, you know who doesn't allow many yards on the ground? Oh, hey, it's Alabama. The most yards per carry they've allowed in any game this season is 3.1 yards per carry. They have not allowed a team to run for more than 106 or 114 yards in any game. So if the Huskies get super one-dimensional, how confident do you feel about Jake Browning's ability to sit back there and pass 60 times against an Alabama defense?
Oh.
All right, so let's talk about how Jake Browning, again.
Wait, so I'm fascinated to see how this run game is going to go.
Yeah.
I mean, because we look at it and we're like, we've got Miles Gaskin. We've got LaVon Coleman. We have it all. And I'm so fascinated to see how this is going to go against the Alabama defense. I mean, it may be the best rushing performance that happens against Alabama all year, and it could still be an ineffective offense.
That's true.
I mean, when I look at this, the thing that scares me about Alabama is not just how great they are on defense, is that they're only getting better. By month, you look at the trends. The Huskies are doing fine, right? They've stayed pretty static throughout the year. Yeah. But you look at Alabama on first downs by month throughout the year. Okay, so in September, it was 13 first downs. October, they were giving up 16 first downs per game, bad month. In November, they gave up 10 first downs per game on average, which is insane. Picking up a first down is a momentous occasion against the Alabama defense.
It's a cause for celebration.
It really is. I mean, 10 first downs is an absurd amount to think of.
Yeah. So, again, you poo-pooed this earlier, but it concerns me, and I've mentioned this. I mentioned this during the Colorado game. I don't know if we've talked about this on the pod since. Jake Browning against good elite pass
defenses.
I'm not
necessarily poo-pooing. I'm saying if we want to feel good about things.
Okay. So he's faced four top 30 pass defenses in terms of yards per attempt so far this season. His cumulative performance in that game, in those games, is completing 50.5% of his passes. In other games, he's completed 69% of his passes. His yards per attempt is actually still pretty decent, 8.1 yards per attempt.
It's all that one John Ross catch against USC.
No, no, it's not that one John Ross catch against USC. It's mostly the fact that against Oregon State, they didn't have many completions, but those generally went for big plays.
God, Oregon State is one of these teams. We're talking about Oregon State in the same conversation as
actually,
Alabama.
Oregon State actually was a pretty good pass defense.
We're talking about Alabama
here. But he went 14 for 28 for 291 against Oregon State, and he was legitimately great against Stanford, 15 of 21 for 210. But against USC, 17 of 36 for 259, and then against Colorado, who was the number one pass defense in the country, 9 of 24 for 118. And the big thing that concerns me is if he's not completing passes consistently...
Well, at least we'll be able to rely on
the run game. Yeah. How do you move the chains? How do you stay on the field? Like, I think the Huskies are going to hit some big plays in this game to John Ross and Dante Pettis, maybe even Chico McClatcher. But how do they mount a consistent drive?
Yeah.
I don't see that answer. And then on the other side, you have Jalen Hurts constantly picking up first downs by scrambling against the pass rush. That's the recipe to me for how Alabama completely dominates this game and wins by multiple touchdowns.
Yeah, and that's why Alabama wins games by multiple touchdowns.
They do.
I mean, you look in that Mississippi State game, the Mississippi game.
Yes.
Mississippi jumped out ahead of Alabama. They went up 24-3, but then Alabama just does that to you.
All right, the other thing. Atlanta, Alabama, we mentioned they're not as balanced in FBI.
Yeah.
Their defensive rating in FBI, 98.1. That is the best on record for FBI, which goes back through 2005. The next best team is Alabama 2011 at 94.5.
That team also won the national championship.
That's how far ahead of any other team in the last 12 years they are on defense. Like, this might be the best defense in college football history.
I mean, 2 yards per carry?
Which is only fifth best in the sportsreference.com database going back to 2000.
Wow.
Pete Carroll had a USC defense that was better than that.
Wow, look at that.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the best, actually, intriguingly, TCU 2008. And guess who TCU played a close game with in the bowl game? They won by 1 point.
Oh, did they? TCU beat Coach Pete?
They did.
I think I remember watching that game.
It was a good game. They played again in 2009, and Boise State won the rematch by 7.
Okay, any other reasons why Alabama's terrified?
Well, that was all I had. The best defense of the last 12 years was sufficient.
I mean, yeah, that's the reason that it boils down to, is the best defense of the last 12 years going against an offense which has been really good but not very good against good defenses and has never seen anything like this.
I mean, the other thing we should mention is when we made those FPI projections, we were treating this as a neutral site game. This is in no sense a neutral site game. This is a, like, semi-home game for Alabama.
Yes. Yep. I don't know. It's so tough to look at this game because you can see that they're coming up against this team that is so clearly the best team in college football. But saying, hey, we're right there and could still lose by 14 points and play a good game.
Yeah.
We should just be happy to be here, I think.
That's how I'm approaching
we're
it.
We're in full-on happy to be here mode.
Yeah.
We can't go into this game expecting to win.
I mean, I don't think that's what Coach Pete is telling the players, but that's as fans how we should be preparing.
But I do think that Coach Pete is telling the players, hey, they're really good.
Yes.
I don't think that anybody is going into the situation. I mean,
I think what he's telling them is they're really good, but they're not unbeatable.
Yes. Nobody's unbeatable.
Exactly.
And Alabama has lost games.
They have lost games. Not in their last 25. But before
that. It's been a while, but Alabama has lost games, and they've lost games of big magnitude, right?
Yes.
They've lost bowl games. They've lost college football playoff games. They're not perfect, and there's a chance there.
They just have the perfect punter.
The Huskies have come up against something that is very hard to beat, but if the Huskies play the way that they played throughout the season in general, and we don't just isolate those games against great defenses, they look like they can win this game.
All right. So All that being said, chances of victory.
I think it's 15%.
I was going to say 15% as well. So there you have it. Definitively a 15%
chance. It's a 15% chance of victory. I mean, I'm so excited to watch this game, to see the Huskies against Alabama. And
I'm just excited to watch the Huskies again. It's been a long time
now. It really has been a long time. But I'm just curious to see what Coach Pete does, because I have a lot of faith in him. And I really think, similar to the way that the Seahawks, when you go into a big game, you don't expect them to lose by more than a touchdown. And I think it ends up being a game that they lose, but I don't think that they lose it by more than a touchdown.
I could see them losing by like 10 points. I feel like they cover the spread, but, you know, it's maybe not really threatening to win the game. I mean, the biggest concern to me is just, you know, to go off that Jake Browning stat, anytime he's had his first option consistently taken away from him, it's been a struggle for Jake Browning. And I, if anyone's going to take away your first option, it's going to be Alabama.
Yeah. Yep. It's, I just can't even, it's such a weird game to talk about.
Yeah. But, it's exciting nonetheless.
I'm excited to be here.
Yes. It's to quote a different Coach Pete, it's a really cool opportunity.
It's a really cool opportunity. And I think this will be a great learning experience for Jake Browning. And I think it could build to something very exciting.
Even after everyone leaves for the NFL. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.